From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. And welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis joins me for a conversation about the Islamic State's latest beheading of journalist Stephen Sotloff, and how the United States continues the debate about how to respond.
The U.S. is supporting Shiite sectarian government in Baghdad. Russia is supporting Shiite sectarian government in Damascus. The Sunnis, trapped in between these two capitals, are caught in a vice grip. ISIS is their champion.
Then Rebecca Cruz provides an update on the growing civil war in Ukraine.
The rebel leaders have actually said and are tweeted that Russians, some of them from the military, are taking their vacations to help out in this situation.
Finally, this half hour, we'll discuss what lessons Arabic scholars can learn from the pushback Dante received when writing the Divine Comedy in the vernacular Italian. These conversations are coming up after this hour's top stories from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Joshua Landis, Rebecca Cruz, let's talk about the news of the week. Of course, we have to start with you, Joshua, and talk about Syria. Another beheading this week of an American journalist that had been kidnapped and held for some time. ISIS clearly gaining strength and no consequences whatsoever to what's going on here. Major media campaigns, social media campaigns, tweeting like crazy about all of their activities, recruiting people to come and join their effort. And yet the U.S. response, where is it? What's going on here?
Well, the U.S. is responding. I mean, we can't forget that there are F-16s flying over these positions. The other day, the Secretary of Defense declared that they had come up now with targets in Syria and a way to bomb in Syria. The problem is that President Obama does not want to rush into Syria without having local allies. And ISIS presents a problem because it's growing stronger. It has the sympathy of many Sunni Muslims throughout the Middle East. The U.S. is supporting Shiite sectarian government in Baghdad. Russia is supporting Shiite sectarian government in Damascus. In many ways, the Sunnis trapped in between these two capitals are caught in a vice grip. ISIS is their champion and is trying to build a state and create national institutions. The other militias have not done that. And consequently, the Sunnis living in this big expanse from Damascus right to Baghdad have been living in constant fear, dislocation, and turmoil. ISIS is trying to provide institutions. It's come up with a new curriculum. We don't like the curriculum at all. It's very disheartening, to say the least. But it's providing some kind of security and order. And people are so hungry after 3 years, almost 4 years now of turmoil, that for the United States to destroy that emerging state, they need to put something else in its place. And that's the challenge for President Obama. Does he want to get into nation building in Syria, and how does he do it? Just bombing is not really an answer for these people.
And these bombings are causing these types of beheadings, right? I mean, they're saying that's in the response. But when you say they need local allies, we've talked about this on the show before. The local ally, is it going to be Assad? I mean, do they need to start working with the Syrian government in order to stop what's going on here with ISIS and its growing strength?
Well, there are people who say that, but President Obama has made it very clear that he's not going to lie. And we believe that recently journalists have come out with a figure of 40,000 opposition troops that are being funded and armed by the United States in Syria who are trying to destroy Assad. And this creates a problem because as you get a failed state in Damascus and as the Syrian state gets undermined, ISIS is profiting from this. So in a sense, by destroying Assad, we are helping ISIS. And that's the question about who do we want to partner with and how do we do it? And we don't have an answer for that. And that's what the president said so clearly the other day. We don't really have a strategy yet. We're working on one. And boy, he needs to develop
one. He needs to get one fast. Well, so to another part of the world, Rebecca, Ukraine, the growing what appears to be civil war in this country, and now a million people in the country displaced. Russian involvement seems to be evident, yet the Russians deny it. The Ukrainians say that they show evidence of having captured Russian soldiers, in fact, in Ukrainian territory. Significant weak response, once again, from the West. What are the options here? I mean, from one difficult situation to another, the options don't seem to be all that great.
Not a lot of easy options, no. And yes, as you mentioned, about 1 million people displaced. About 250,000 to 300,000 have gone over into Russia. Russia has been offering kind of allowing people to come in on a visitor's visa and not charging any sort of fees. So they're seeing a lot of people there. Estonia has an estimated 20,000 people that have entered that country. President Obama was there this week kind of promising Estonia that they were keeping an eye out and would not let this conflict bleed over. But also Poland, Finland, and Sweden are taking in refugees, or what might be classified as refugees, and then internally displaced. We're talking about huge numbers of people that are having to go and live with families, trying to get out of these war-torn areas. And yes, Russia is saying that they are not involved, but there is significant evidence that they are. The rebel leaders have actually said and are tweeted that Russians, some of them from the military, are taking their vacations to help out in this situation. What we have been seeing this week, though, is talks in perhaps the right direction, as Putin and the president of Ukraine have been kind of talking about some sort of a ceasefire, some sort of a freeze. Now, what that will actually look like and how that will be implemented is a little up in the air at the moment. As far as a Western response this week, also we see the NATO summit in Wales. This is why President Obama was in Estonia, making his way to Wales. And the General Secretary Rasmussen has said that this is perhaps one of the most crucial summits that NATO has had in its 60-plus year history, that there's a lot going on, obviously, them pulling out of Afghanistan and ISIS, but really focusing on the Ukrainian situation. And they did invite representatives from Ukraine to come and join in on some of these meetings. They are also implementing or thought to implement a new multilateral task force that will be able to travel light but strike hard, and they will go into these types of situations. This probably won't help Ukraine, but if there is something that happens in Estonia, Latvia, or in the area, they would be able to strike at that point.
Well, we'll definitely be waiting to see what happens in those discussions about both of these cases, as these are just incredible challenges that the United States and its allies are facing today. So thank you both for being here today on Worldviews to share your thoughts.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation and answer any questions you may have. Send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU, or you can contact each of us directly at Suzette Grelot, at Cruz226, or at Joshua_Landis. You can also leave your comments on the Worldviews page in the Programs section of KGOU.org. Coming up, Joshua and I talk with Boston College Near East historian and political scientist Frank Salome about the Arabic language and some of the challenges of teaching it. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. Today we're joined by political scientist and Near East historian Frank Salome. He teaches courses on states and minorities in the Middle East and Arabic literature at Boston College. He's also the author of the book Language, Memory, and Identity in the Middle East, The Case for Lebanon. Frank Salome, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Your work as a professor of Arabic language is very, very interesting. You've written a book most recently. You have several things coming out, but most recently one that was published, Language, Memory, and Identity in the Middle East. And in this book, you talk about modern standard Arabic and how the teaching of modern standard Arabic is somehow intellectually stifling because it is not a living spoken language. Can you tell us what you mean by that being intellectually stifling?
When we say Arabic in the academy, when we teach Arabic, we say we teach Arabic. We're forming Arabists. We're forming people who we say who speak Arabic. But in reality, it's people who use Arabic. We're usually talking about one kind of Arabic, and there are many kinds of Arabics. I argue that there are 36 different languages that are mutually unintelligible. Most of them are mutually unintelligible. That we refer to generically as Arabic, and there isn't a bona fide Arabic language. And Arabic is referred to as Fusha, which is in English modern standard Arabic, and that is the Arabic that we teach in the academy. So to give you an analogy that would be comprehensible to a Western audience, when I say I'm teaching you Arabic and then I'm telling you, here, take 3 years of Arabic and then go to Egypt and speak to the Egyptians. In a Western context, this would be as if I were giving you 3 years of Latin and telling you to go to Naples or Milan and communicate with the peoples. So that's the Arabic that we teach. So it's a learned language. It's a ceremonial language. It's a language of literature. But it's nobody's natively spoken language. It's a language that is acquired through years and years of schooling. On the other hand, you have these 36 different varieties that are referred to as dialects. Some of them are mutually intelligible. Others are not. And this would be comparable to, say, again, in a European context, to Italian, French, Portuguese, Romanian, and the relationships that these languages have among each other and with the mother language, Latin. Stifling, I'm not sure I used that term. Limiting, perhaps. That is because people don't use it natively, don't use it spontaneously. It is used in conversation among the educated, but it's almost always out of a prepared text. It is not a spontaneously spoken language.
So this, maybe the stifling or the limiting nature of it, as you suggest, then, is that it's misleading to think that there's any kind of modern standard Arabic that is inclusive of the entire Arab world, and that this somehow limits our understanding of this part of the world and leads to certain perceptions, some sort of monolithic whole, and isn't diverse and, you know, full of many different kinds of cultures and languages and ways of life.
That language that is common to all of the Arab-defined countries, that modern standard Arabic, is comprehensible to all of the users of this language as long as they've had formation in it. And that's why I stress the fact that it's not a natively used language. You have to go through schooling to. Linguists speak a lot in terms of the glossia, and that is, you know, having two language personalities, one for certain events, certain situations, and another for more sort of colloquial situations. But in the case of the glossia, both languages are learned at the same time. Both languages are acquired at the same time. That is not the case with Arabic. So Arabic is, in a sense, like Latin, that was used by bona fide Latins, Romans, as a native language, but was also used by barbarians and peoples who were conquered by the Latins, the Romans, who acquired that language eventually and distorted it over time and made out of it what we commonly refer to as French and Spanish and to a certain extent, English.
Our guest today is Frank Salome from Boston College. More of our conversation right after a break. I'm Suzette Grelot, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Our guest today is Frank Salome from Boston College, where he teaches courses on the Middle East and Arabic language. He's also written the book Language, Memory, and Identity in the Middle East, The Case for Lebanon. When we left off, he compared some of the challenges of teaching Arabic to the difficulty of teaching Latin. Joining me in this conversation is Joshua Landis.
Islam connects to Arabic because Arabic, the Quran, is God sends down his message. The third package in this Abrahamic tradition, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and then the newest testament, the Quran, to the Arab people in the Arabic language.
Correct.
So it is God's language.
Correct.
And modern Arab nationalists said Arabic is the first language. I mean, they made this sort of romantic notion of Arabic being God's language, that Adam and Eve spoke Arabic. Zakir al-Suzi, the Ba'ath Party founders and so forth, all say this, that Arabic is God's language and Semitic is the first language. But this is still at the heart of Arab nationalism. It's the heart of politics. I was just watching a video today of rebels going into Latakia area in northern Syria, pushing out government forces, and they are speaking this Fusha Arabic that you're talking about and saying that they are raising God's word to the top and that that this is what they're doing. So this is a project that's still ongoing in the Middle East. You're saying this is a false project?
I'm not saying it's a false project. I'm just saying that it's a daunting project. Arab nationalists have attempted it, started in the 1930s, 1940s. It still has not worked. I mean, when you have a situation where upwards of 50-55% of the population is unable to function in that language, how can you enforce it? When you have to engage a literacy campaign before you engage a nationalist campaign, that's a daunting project. What you described about the holiness of the Arabic language being, you know, the language of Quran, etc., to a certain extent, that was the case of Latin as well.
Right.
And that monopoly was broken because ultimately it's people who decide what they want to speak, what is, you know, their maternal, their mother language, they say in French, right. Langue maternelle, the mother language, the language that you learn from your mother. I don't see how this is going. It may succeed, but I don't see any signs that this is indeed going to succeed. There will be a great deal of opposition. This happened with Latin. Latin did not switch overnight to French and Italian and Spanish. The purists, the Latinists, the people who wanted to maintain the superiority of Latin fought it vehemently. I mean, you had groups in the 15th century France who refused to use Latin, who wanted to write exclusively in the vulgar language, in French.
It's also the case in Lebanon, isn't it? I mean, in not just in Lebanon, throughout the Middle East, you have churches, Christians in particular, whose liturgy is not in Arabic. There are some, like the Greek Orthodox, whose liturgy is in Arabic, but many others whose liturgy is not in Arabic, either in Aramaic or
Correct.
Where does this leave them? Is this Arabic language stifling for these minorities who hold up other languages?
Well, and just to get to that, add to that, Frank, I mean, the subtitle of your book is The Case for Lebanon. So you obviously take a particular focus on Lebanon, particularly for this reason that it doesn't seem to fit with the rest of the Middle East, and that the language that we understand everyone to speak, it shapes and kind of misshapes our perceptions of that country and of that region.
Well, the case for Lebanon, the reason for the four in the subtitle is that my approach is that Lebanon could be looked at as perhaps a template, perhaps as an experiment where and it's always been a kind of a barometer where new ideas were tested and spread elsewhere. But to go back to your question, Josh, the churches that you mentioned, there has been a great deal of Arabization within churches whose liturgical languages had not been Arabic. The Maronite Church, for instance. I mean, the Maronites were the leaders in introducing Arabic into church rituals and prayers and so forth. But there is a movement now going back to either dialectalization or going back to Aramaic. So you'll see a return back to Syriac in the Maronite church, and others are following suit. But I want to go back to a point that I think is very, very important, because people, especially nationalists, are emotionally attached to their linguistic lodestar, the Arabic language for the Arab nationalists, the French for the French, etc. And we feel that language is this holy organism that we shouldn't tamper with, especially in the case of Arabic language, given its religious importance. In the 13th century, Dante published something you're probably familiar with, La Commedia, the comedy. That was the title of the book, the comedy. It wasn't divine yet. He was fought at the academy by his colleagues, who told him, how dare you write, because he wrote it in his vernacular. And I use Dante as an example because he is, in a way, the child of Virgil. He is the prince of Latin. I mean, nobody has beautified Latin as Dante has. And yet he writes in this vulgar language. But then everybody knows the book. Everybody understands the book. Even people who can't read, the book could be read to them and they could understand it. And over time, La Commedia became La Divina Commedia, the divine comedy, due to its subject matter, perhaps. But certainly, the divinity of it is attributable to the language, because it was a beautiful, vulgar language that he used. And when his colleagues at the academy fought him, there's a parallel to this in the Middle East today among those literati who are writing, Egyptians who are writing in the Egyptian dialect, Lebanese who are writing in the Lebanese dialect, Syrians who are writing in the Syrian dialect, publishing. Dante was accused of using the language of the lower classes, the language of servants, not the language of academicians. And this was a verbal debate. And Dante's response was very similar to what goes on in the Arab world today, was that you are fighting my language choice in the language that I have chosen as a written language. They were not debating him in Latin. They were debating him in that lowly language. And that lowly language, he said, is your language, is my language, is the language of my mother, is the language of our prince. It's the language that we use on a daily basis. So that's a similar debate is ongoing today in the Middle East. Of course, you're going to have those who are emotively, religiously attached to the language who approach it from a different different aspect, a different corner. But the debate is ongoing. And you have respectable literati who are attempting to normalize that tendency to write in the spoken language. And I mean, Najib Mahfouz, for instance, if you read his books in Arabic, he is also one of the princes of the Arabic language, a Nobel laureate. All of his internal dialogues in his novels are in spoken Egyptian. And that is because, like Dante, he feels that he could not express the innermost feelings of the masses, the subject of his book, unless he makes them speak in their spoken languages.
So just very quickly, tell us, should we not be teaching modern standard Arabic? Is that the ultimate argument here?
That is absolutely not my argument. My argument is that we should teach it. It has a function. It has a very important function. It is still the language of literature. I mean, you amputate people from their literature when you tell them don't use that language anymore. But what I suggest is that we learn it, we teach it the way we learned it in the Middle East. First, the mother language, and then the scholarly language.
Well, Frank Salome, thank you so much for joining us today. You've given us a lot to think about.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to our conversation with Boston College Near East historian and political scientist Frank Salome. We have a link to his book, Language, Memory, and Identity in the Middle East, The Case for Lebanon, on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews through a collaborative partnership with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Symphony Swift conducts research for the interviews and books our guests. Our interns, Sarah Hurd and Holly Arias, prepared our digital content for the web. And the show is produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Grelott.